from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, a blaze tore through a two-story converted warehouse in Oakland's Fruitvale neighborhood on Friday night, claiming the lives of at least 36 people attending a late-night party there. The warehouse, known as Ghost Ship, was home to a community of artists and had been under investigation for a range of permit and safety violations. We'll bring you the latest updates on the tragedy and discuss its impact on the Bay Area art scene, as well as ways to ensure that other tragedies of this kind do not occur again. Join us for Forum. It's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. On Friday night, an electronic music concert in a 10,000-square-foot building in Oakland's Fruitvale District, known as Ghost Ship, turned into a deadly inferno. The two-story warehouse, which had become an artist collective, became the site of a five-alarm fire. With a death toll reaching 36 and still climbing, it was one of the deadliest structure fires in the country in the past decade and claimed more lives than the Oakland Hills fire of 1991. In this opening Forum Hour, we update you on the tragic fire and discuss the many issues and concerns that have emerged. And we want to go first to Oakland and welcome Mayor Libby Schaff, who's with us by phone this morning. Mayor, good to have you with us.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. And in the wake of this tragedy, let me just say condolences to all those who have lost loved ones, and certainly kudos to those who are digging through the mess here and doing the tedious work that's necessary and that's so involved. But I wanted to ask, first of all, from all appearances, this could have been avoided, should have been avoided.
I think it's a little early to assign blame to anyone. I think it is really important that the public and the media stays focused on the most important thing, and that is recovering the victims and supporting these families that are getting the news that no one should ever have to get, which is that a loved one, and in many, many cases, a child, has been lost. We also are working to ensure that our public safety crews are working safely and humanely. We have had an incredible sense of teamwork with all the different agencies that are having to cooperate around such a massive operation. We are doing everything in this recovery process to not just be humane and compassionate about the victims, but to treat this scene very carefully to preserve all evidence, because we know that everyone is going to demand answers.
Well, there is a criminal there is a criminal investigation going on as well, is there not?
The criminal investigation team has been activated. The district attorney has a representative on the site, and this is absolutely being investigated in this manner.
But we've also heard, Mayor Schaff, that work has stopped due to unsafe structure. What's the status of the recovery efforts?
Well, I can give you what is probably some breaking news, which is that we, again, have been working very hard, and we have the clearance to resume work at 9:15 this morning. I'm sure you've heard that so far we've recovered 36 victims. We've cleared 80% of the building. The remaining 20% of the building that remains to be cleared is in the section of the building that we believe is where the fire started. And that is part of why the wall is so structurally unsafe.
But the cause of the fire is still not known at this point.
That is correct.
And we're also reading, when I asked you should it not have happened or could not have happened, and I didn't mean that as a rush to judgment, but certainly what's been reported is there were no permits for entertainment or anything except this being a warehouse. There were no sprinklers. There was no fire alarm. There was one rickety stair. And there were investigators who went there and sort of walked away when nobody opened the door for them.
It is absolutely true that the legally permitted use for this building was only as a warehouse, and that there were no permits for events or for the event that night. It is true that there is an open investigation on the building that was made on November 13th. The inspector went out to inspect on November 17th, did do a notice of violation for the external blight or trash and debris, but was unable to gain access into the building, and so that portion of the complaint had remained opened.
There's also been some criticism about the city not taking fire safety issues seriously enough before the fire occurred. You would say what to that?
There are a lot of high emotions right now. And again, we are remaining focused on what the appropriate priorities are. That is victim recovery, that is safety of all the many workers, and that is preservation of evidence so that a thorough investigation can be conducted. We are pulling all public records, every official piece of knowledge that the city had and the county had around this building, because the public deserves to have a comprehensive record. But that information is not yet available in a way that is accurate and comprehensive, and so people are just going to have to wait for that.
Well, what should people do who are still wondering if their loved ones are okay at this
point? So we have a family assistance center. They can come here in person. It is on East 12th Street. It's the sheriff's substation. We have grief counselors here. We have the Red Cross here. It is open from 8 in the morning till 8 p.m. There's additional information, and I personally come several times a day to brief the families that are present as well. We've set up an email notification system just for the families so that we get them very timely information. But the horrible, horrible work that is happening today is that as the coroner is able to get substantial identification of the victims, we are engaging in the unthinkable work of sitting down with families in person and giving them the information that their loved one was a victim of this fire. There is a lot of that is going to be happening today. The other work that's happening is really the healing. This is an incredible community, the community of Oakland. We are compassionate and we are full of creative talent. And I would urge people to join the arts community tonight at Lake Merritt at the pergolas at the end of the lake at 8 p.m. People are asked to bring their own candle and a cup to protect it if it's windy. I think that there is going to be a great amount of not just blaming, but of solutions, of proactive and positive steps taken to ensure that these types of things are avoided.
I'm also wondering, since most of the victims in this fire appear to be college students, artists, young artists, and certainly young artists who probably cannot afford the rents in Oakland. I mean, it's been pointed out that a lot of them were staying there because they simply found the cost too high in terms of what they had financially. I'm just wondering what you say to those who say they're concerned and anxious about possibly the city of Oakland coming down now too strong and overreacting in the wake of this terrible tragedy.
There is tremendous fear in the artist community right now that is just piled on top of their grief and mourning for this incredible part of their community, that there is going to be an overreaction, a zealous response that will result in mass evictions of artists. And I can just tell you, as the mayor of Oakland, my commitment is that we have both, that we have safety, not just fire safety and building safety, but safety of community. Many people live in these communities because these are people in our trans community, our queer community, our creative community that want to have a community of safety for them. And that is paramount for us. And we can accomplish that and support and lift up and nurture the incredible creativity that makes this city the city that we love so much. And that is something that we cannot afford to lose.
And you say what to those Oakland residents who are concerned at this point about really what they should know and what they should do?
We are going to be having daily briefings multiple times a day. This is going to be a long haul, both just the actual recovery operation, the notifications of the families, and then the information that the public is going to need. I can just talk about the steps that I'm taking to ensure that we get thorough information and a thorough investigation of what in fact happened, as well as what our systems are, what they should have been, and what they could be. even if our systems are state of the art, there is always room for improvement. We have been very thankful for Cal OES to send in their regional director. Today, the state of California's fire marshal is arriving. Mass casualties expert for the state of California has been advising us. I have pulled in independent expert eyes to advise and to evaluate not only how we are addressing our situation right now, but what we had done in the past, what our knowledge of the building was, and how we interacted with that building. I am going to be looking carefully and critically at all of that. But I just have to say that we have not been able to put together the comprehensive public record that the media and the public, and particularly the families, deserve. But we are working as hard as we can to do that.
Well, let me wish you the best of luck with that, Mayor Schaaf, and thank you for joining us this morning. And I know there's tough times ahead for you meeting with these families and so forth. So, again, best of luck with that as well.
Well,
it's going to be hard to comfort these people.
I appreciate that. That is where our focus is, as well as supporting our first responders. And I have to say that as experts from the state of California have come in to look at the operation that we are conducting to recover these victims, they have been incredibly impressed with the professionalism of our first responders, with their collaboration with the other agencies. I want to assure the public that the competency and compassion of these public servants is something that we all have a lot to be proud of.
Libby Schaaf is mayor of Oakland. And again, Mayor Schaaf, good to have you with us. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you, Michael.
We also have Sonja Dirks with us, who's been covering this story. She's a reporter for KQED. Sonja, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Michael.
Well, this was an accident waiting to happen, wasn't it? I mean, it was a death trap.
It has been this particular warehouse has been described as a death trap, a tinderbox. You know, there have been pictures sort of posted online where you can see that it has this sort of funky gypsy artist's vibe. I've been in buildings like this before. I've been to parties in warehouses like this before. But, you know, one of the things that goes along with it is that you can see how it might just go up like that because there were lanterns, there were fabric everywhere. You know, as we learn more about what was happening inside the building, we come to understand maybe just how dangerous and tragic this whole entire situation is.
Well, what do we know about the victims? As I said to Mayor Schaaf, from what I've read, we're talking about a lot of young people, about artists and essentially musicians for the most part.
Yeah, no, I mean, these are very much young people. These are very much people that are embedded within Oakland's, you know, art scene, which is a thriving scene, both sort of the underground scene and then and just in general. But, you know, the youngest victim at this point we know of is 17 and was a high school student. We also know that this has affected people across great swaths of Oakland and the East Bay and San Francisco as well. I mean, the Alameda Sheriff's Department, which is one of the key first responders, one of their deputies, his son, was killed in the fire. So it's, you know, it's not just from the arts community. It's the first responder community. It's our local colleges. We know that there are Berkeley students who are missing. We know that one of the missing was a San Francisco State student. So we also know that some of the people who are missing and presumed dead are not from the States. They're from Asia and Europe. So it just cuts across. It's deeply impactful across the world.
And at this point, where are we? We were at 70% last I read in terms of clearing and so forth.
And the mayor just said 80%.
Oh, it's gone up to 80. That's right. So, but nevertheless, they've got the Alameda Coroner's Bureau asking for preserving of DNA for identifying. I mean, it's a ghastly job that is being done here.
Yeah. I mean, you could just see the looks on the first responders' faces yesterday. I spent the entire day at the scene. It's a huge and massive operation in Oakland's Fruitvale District. And you could just see the first responders, you know, their faces were covered in soot. They were carrying shovels, and you could sometimes see them with the buckets that they were using to quite literally bucket by bucket take out the debris that was cluttering the inside of this warehouse, this husk, this shell, as they tried to create a path to get to the victims and bring them, you know, bring them safely out. So it was just kind of, you could just tell that everybody was so was so emotionally drained from the people who were speaking to the mayor, to everyone surrounding the area.
Do we know how many are still missing?
We don't know exactly how many are still missing, but it's not a small amount. From what I've seen of people who are still seeking their loved ones, there's more than a dozen.
I've seen actually on Facebook safe. I mean, people posting that they're safe and so forth. A lot of that.
Yeah. Yes, there's the that feature that Facebook has where you can sort of say, you know, was marked safe at this event. People are using that. I think someone actually marked me safe because I hadn't done it for myself, and they heard me on the radio and realized I was okay. But yeah, no, people are marking themselves safe. People are using Facebook as a way to try to find out about their friends. They're posting on the event page, this event that happened on Friday night. They're posting on that saying, you know, even now they're saying, you know, my friend is still missing. If you've seen him, if he's out there, please get in touch. People are still holding out hope, even perhaps if they fear the worst, you know, news.
We're talking with Sandhya Dirks, who's here with us in studio, who is a reporter for KQED. And Nihar Bhatt is a DJ with San Francisco Surface Tension Collective. He witnessed the fire. He lost six friends to the blaze. Nihar Bhatt, welcome to the forum program and sorry about your losses.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Tell us what you saw.
So on Friday night, I was coming to this warehouse, and it's a warehouse that you know, I've actually performed at before myself. You know, I've been to many events there over the last few months, and I arrived around 11:15. I was about to enter the building, but a good friend of mine was outside. He was one of the performers, Russell Butler. Actually two of my friends, another one, Joey Cassio, was standing outside. I stopped to speak to them before going in. Joey entered the building in the middle of our conversation, but I stayed to talk to Russell. And within a few minutes of that, we heard someone scream fire, and people started exiting the building. And, you know, all of us sort of panicked and wanted to sort of move toward the building to see what we could do. But within less than a minute, the building started billowing black smoke. That black smoke that's been talked about a lot, that sort of just filled the entire place, you know, so much quicker than you could imagine. And it was just impossible to enter at that point. We in horror realized that a very small percentage of the people that we knew were inside had actually exited the building. And that realization sort of slowly dawned on us as we waited. I waited with friends for hours outside of that building.
You also had a lot of people upstairs, and you had this rickety staircase, and it was just single file, yeah?
Most of the people I know were upstairs, because that's where the event was, actually. It was the main event was happening upstairs, and that was where most of the people were trapped.
And most of the people were there to see this this group that was on tour. It was a musical group.
Yeah, it was a combination of the, you know, an act from out of town, but also a lot of local artists who, you know, the thing about the space is that, you know, despite the fact that it was absolutely, you know, there was absolutely a hazard. Obviously, there were huge safety problems, and many of us were aware of the safety problems. It was also a very unique and beautiful place to play. It sort of brought out a different type of experience to play music there, which is what attracted people to it, despite the risks. And sort of, yeah, so we were there to sort of help our friends. It was a very community-based event. It was very much, you know, about, you know, celebrating the people around us. You know, it's kind of one of the things that made it a different type of event, one of the things that makes these warehouse parties unique and special.
We're talking with Nihar Bhatt, who is a DJ with the San Francisco Surface Tension Collective, who witnessed the fire and lost six friends to the blaze. How much of this in your mind or the mind of your friends and those in your group, your community, as you describe it, has to do with the crisis in housing and gentrification in terms of those who were living there and actually set up there?
I mean, I think it had a lot to do with that. You know, who attend events like this, people who choose to live and work in, you know, art and performance spaces, you know, usually are people, you know, we don't identify with sort of things, you know, the mainstream sort of club culture or, you know, necessarily, you know, mainstream ways of living and doing art, we try to find unique and outsider spaces to share our work with each other and to celebrate. But you know, the official way that you're allowed to sort of do late night art, essentially, which is what a dance party is, really. You know, it's a piece of art. It's a way of expressing our creativity. You know, officially sanctioned way to do that is to go to a place that is really about selling alcohol. And that's not what we do this for. We do this for the music, for the joy, for the connection. So this type of space is essential to that type of culture and community. And, you know, so it's not optional. So that, but because of the housing crisis, I think, you know, those types of spaces, you know, without a doubt, there are so many fewer spaces like that in the Bay Area. The Bay Area had always been a hub of that type of alternative space. And there were so many fewer places for us. There were so many less options. You know, we're always, you know, people are always looking for some place to do something out of the ordinary or something special and something that can go late night. Because one of the things about, it's actually a really important element of this, is that because alcohol sales close at 2, most of the places where we can do this stuff go at 2. But the music we're making is about the late night. It is it actually has to be consumed late night. And it's just one of the reasons why we do this, why we find places like that. So, you know, all of that might seem frivolous because obviously the bread and butter issue of people having housing, affordable housing is prime. But the reality is these are really essential, important things for many people.
Housing is a central issue, but also so is young people finding a way, what you're describing, outlets for things like art and music. And I should mention, we're coming up on a break. I want you to stay with us, if you would, Nihar,
sure,
because I want to find out about, give us maybe a sense of some of those who you lost here, who were dear to you. But let me just go back, Sonja Dirks, for a moment as we come up on the break. This was under investigation by city officials for blight and for unpermitted construction. There were complaints. What happened to all the complaints? What happened to the investigation?
It's not completely clear. We do know that investigators did stop by and knock on the door and no one answered. And we know that they're looking into, I mean, this is part of the investigation that they're launching. What happened? Where are the resources to do this kind of investigation? And how do we have regulation that balances the need for safety with sort of this underground spirit that really is the soul of Oakland?
Well, we're going to find out more about this deadly tragedy, and we're also going to invite you to join us with your thoughts and reflect on what you would like to talk about in the wake of this tragedy. Any questions you might have are also welcome, and we invite you to join us now at our toll-free number. That number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Join us now, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also join the program by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Excuse me. Feel free to join the program. We're talking now with Sonja Dirks and Nihar Bhatt, and we'll talk with you and hear from you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the terrible fire that occurred and began Friday night in Oakland in the Fruitvale District. Death toll in that warehouse now climbing as searches continue. We spoke earlier with Mayor Libby Schaff, and Sonja Dirks, reporter for KQED, is here with us in studio. We have Nihar Bhatt on the line, who is a DJ with the San Francisco Surface Tension Collective, who witnessed the fire and lost a number of friends to that blaze. Getting a lot of personal responses. Rick writes, my youngest daughter was invited by a boyfriend who escaped. Fortunately, she did not go. She said that this music community is like family. What a terrible rip in this community. Let me go to your calls and let me go to Gabrielle in Oakland. Gabrielle, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to call in to let you guys know that I just recently was informed by one of the first grade teachers at Coronado Elementary School, Ms. Wolfman, telling me that Ms. Sarah Hoda passed away. She was a kindergarten teacher at Coronado Elementary School in Richmond, and she just retired last year. So this is her first year not being there. So I just left the school, and they're having the crisis people talk to the kids in first grade, mainly in second grade, because they're really close to her. So I just wanted to tell you guys that and spread my condolences to whoever might be listening who might have known her.
Now, these losses are monumental, and it's kind of you to call on that. I appreciate hearing from you, Gabrielle. And I want to go back to Nihar Bhatt and give us a sense, if you could. It's been a great loss to you with six friends dying in this blaze. Who were they? Tell us about them.
Sure. I think there were many people I knew even beyond this six, not as well, but six of them were very important to me personally. The names of these six, Barrett, Chelsea, Johnny, Cash, Joey, and Micah, they were all leaders in our scene. And there were people that, there were people that personally, encouraged me. We were collaborators, friends, family, like people have said. I could talk specifically about any of them.
Well, the fact is, they were your friends, and they were people who you are grieving.
Exactly. I mean, just as an example, Chelsea Faith was someone who, as I developed as a DJ, she had been doing it for quite a bit longer than me. Even though we were around the same age, she had just been doing her practice for a lot longer. And whenever I played, she made an effort. She didn't have to do this. People are often very competitive in sort of a music scene, or DJs can be competitive with each other. But every time I played, she would come and talk to me about my set, about what she liked about it, what might have been different. She really took notice and paid attention and cared about me as an artist. And it always mattered to me, like all those little things that she did. And when she played, she took me to school. It was always an education and the way that she was able to weave a narrative with her music. And I just will never forget that. And these little things, you don't think about them when you are, you don't think about them enough when they're happening. You're just like, this is a really nice person. But when I reflect on it, it's so important to how I developed as an artist.
I'll cherish the memories, and let me bring another caller on here who wants to talk about the fire. John, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm also part of the community. I'm so sorry to your guest on there for what he's dealing with. And I'm also part of the same community and lost multiple friends in the fire. It's happened, and there are other people. But while I really cared for these people, there are other people I know who are hurting at a level that I cannot even comprehend, who are very, very close to them. And the grief and the tragedy of this is overpowering, and it is really, it's ripping a hole in a very tight-knit and creatively powerful community. And like the speaker mentioned, these are people who were leaders and powerful artists and powerful personalities within the community in this scene. But there's something very important that people are quickly realizing. It has to be understood that we've been listening to since day one, because these are also people who are highly aware, and the people who are gone were highly aware of threats to our lives and to our community and our culture. And a lot of people in this community and culture are marginalized people economically, mental health-wise, people who are people of color, people who are on the queer spectrum, trans spectrum. These are people who have difficulties being able to find housing otherwise, who have difficulties being able to afford to live in a place like the Bay Area. It's very, very hard here. And we are forced into independent circumstances, sometimes that can be very difficult. But these realities are here. And listening to people like Mayor Schaaf and Councilman Gallo, and listening to the coverage on KTVU News, for their instance, the first day, where they were literally talking about doing a urban shield style military style SWAT public partnership invasion of DIY spaces to shut them all down. Basically, their response is to attempt to crush this culture, which is suffering so much right now. It isn't to reach out and give them comfort. It is to crush the culture. This is not about the first responders and the people who are trying to help and being there, but there are politicians and there are people who are involved in the media, in the mainstream media here, who have ties to developers, who have ties to interests that will profit from this. And they are planning to crush this culture for profit, and they need to be checked, because this is something that none of these people who are gone would have wanted. They need to be mourned, and we need to be able to get our mourning.
John, forgive me. I want to come in here because I want to go to the heart of your concerns and bring Sonia Dirks back into this. I mean, this is what a lot of young people who are in this community are expressing. They're feeling not only a lack of sensitivity, perhaps, from politicians, which is often the case in the wake of a tragedy of this kind or any kind, for that matter, but also feeling that they're being not recognized for what they need here. I mean, what the needs are pretty clear. They've been expressed pretty clear.
And I think there's fear of a double tragedy. There's fear of an overcorrection, a crackdown on artists, on this underground artist scene. And I think that, you know, obviously gentrification is an incredibly anxiety-filled topic, and it affects everyone. Displacement affects people of color. It affects marginalized people. It affects trans people. It affects artists. We've seen that in Oakland. We've seen that in other places in the Bay Area. So I think that there is this sense, this deep anxiety over a double tragedy, over not just the loss of these beloved people who were so important to this community, but also a fear that there will be a response that uses this as an excuse to continue to gentrify certain things. Now, we have also seen the strength of this community, their unity, and obviously, you know, if Oakland is involved in a lot of engagement around trying to prevent displacement and gentrification, and so, you know, I think that there is a moment here for this community to kind of bring its voice to bear, as we're hearing from people who are, you know, both filled with that anxiety, but also, you know, trying to kind of best understand how to honor the work and the lives of their friends.
Well, President Obama has put out a statement on the Oakland fire. I want to read it. He says, "Today our prayers go out to the people of Oakland." And he says, "In the aftermath of this weekend's deadly warehouse fire, one of the worst fires in the state's history, while we still don't know the full toll of this disaster, we do know that an American community has been devastated, and many people, including young men and women, with their whole futures ahead of them, have tragically lost their lives." And we're getting these kinds of questions. I asked the mayor this, but let me go to you and see if you can shed some light on it for us, Sonia Dirks. Annie asks, "Why do the inspectors not do more? They have the right to insist on being admitted to the building and to contact the landlord. I hope the landlord will be held responsible. How long does under investigation take?"
Well, you know, the problem is that this kind of investigation is often complaint-based. And when you are living in—
A lot of complaints were coming in on this building and other buildings like it.
There were some complaints with this building, but, you know, it takes a lot of resources that Oakland doesn't necessarily have to do these kinds of inspections. And I think Oakland's going to have to ask itself a lot of questions about its process and whether it needs to change its process and to reinforce its process of kind of regulating these sort of liminal spaces. Spaces like this warehouse. But, you know, definitely there are some even complications about who managed the space. There's the landlord, and then there's the person who ran the collective and ran the space. So, you know, who's at fault, what that means, where the city failed, all of those things are going to play out in the coming days and weeks.
Well, on that note, I want to go to Thomas Peel, who's going to be joining us by phone. He's an investigative reporter with the Bay Area News Group. And Thomas Peel, good to have you with us on Forum. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me again, Michael. Appreciate it.
I appreciate your being with us. Let's talk about Derek Ian Almina, who ran this artist collective, and also the man whom he rented it from.
What they're talking about with this gentleman, Michael, is that everyone there had full knowledge that this place was a tinderbox. It was filled with wood. That was his primary artistic endeavor, I am told. One person told me that he had a fetish for wood, that there was simply pile after pile of scrap wood. There were heaps of used cedar shingles. There were all kinds of woodworking going on, that some of the structures made inside the warehouse, little living structures, were primarily of wood. Many of them were even shingled. And that there were electrical wires going every place, extension cords. There were camper grills. There were butane and propane tanks throughout the throughout the floor plan on the first floor.
So, again, it was a death trap, and it was something that could have been avoided and should have been avoided, as I said earlier. But the reality is that where's the culpability? I mean, you've got somebody running entertainment in a place that had, as we found out earlier from Mayor Schaff, a license only to be a warehouse. You've
right.
got – and there's been a lot of anger on Facebook against the man who was running this collective, Derek Ian Almena, because he was talking about his losses and nobody in his family died or he didn't die.
Michael, he issued a statement earlier today. He is now claiming that when he wrote that rather infamous Facebook post that has gotten thousands of responses and made people so angry, that he didn't know there had been a loss of life. Now, but, just to play devil's advocate with that, that was Saturday morning, probably 8 hours after the fire, 9 hours after the fire, and he knew the building was gone. And he knew that maybe 2 dozen people were living there at any given time. So,
but he also knew things needed to be fixed in that building,
yeah,
and
that
so did
anybody,
the owner of the building, right?
Well, the owner of the building has said through her daughter that they didn't know anybody was living there. Again, that's their position at this time, or what we've been told. It's clearly at best a case of absentee landlordism. This person owns about a dozen different properties in Oakland. And we understand that when the party, the dance party occurred, because what this artist's community would do is when it was rent time, they might let out the upper space there where the dance parties are in order to make money for rent.
They were calling it Satya Yoga. They were calling it essentially a collective and a commune. But that artist collective was run by this gentleman, Derek Almena, who in your article in East Bay Express, your report, has said some very strange and odd things about being the love child of Charles Manson, Pol Pot, and Hitler. Do I have that right?
Yes, he wrote on in a Facebook post in July that he was the thriller love child of Manson, Pol Pot, and Hitler. That was in a 1,000-word screed on Facebook that I guess can best be described as really bad attempt at William Burroughs or something. I mean, it just was absolutely senseless.
And talking about proverbially getting away with murder, that I can proverbially
yes.
get away with
he
murder.
He claimed that he could proverbially get away with murder. Now, there's a reference there to a urinalysis test, and we know that he was on felony probation for receiving stolen property last year, and he pled out to that charge. I can surmise that perhaps some of this was about him having to have interaction with the probation department, the reference to your analysis. I mean, that's about the only sense that can be made of it, frankly.
Thomas Peel is investigative reporter of the Bay Area News Group. And here's a comment from Mike, who says, I'm a building inspector for a large municipality here in the Bay Area. I work in code enforcement, and I know that you can only enforce as much of the code as the will of the building department or city hall will allow. Oakland was not about to force people, artists, out onto the street, because that would be seriously bad publicity for all the city hall politicians. Want to comment, Thomas Peel?
Well, Michael, what we know is that there was a complaint by a neighbor about garbage outside the building, which seemed to be a continuing problem. One of the things that people say was inside the building were dozens and dozens of large pieces of furniture. Sofas, armchairs, pianos, and they would eventually find their way out into a vacant lot next to the building and on the curb. Somebody complained. Code enforcement came, and code enforcement, we were told that the officer attempted to get in, that said that no one was there. I believe this was November 17th, and didn't go back, although that visit initiated an investigation that was ongoing as of Friday night about illegal interior structures within the warehouse, these little dwelling units and artist studios that people had cobbled together with all this scrap material. So clearly they knew from that there was an illegal use of the building going on. There's no question that the city knew that.
Again, Thomas Peel, investigative reporter with the Bay Area News Group. And speaking about what the city may or may not have known, here's Carol, who writes, I feel for Mayor Libby Schaff, but the focus she claims solely being with the grieving families looks a little thin after years of an obvious focus by developers and city planners on profit at the expense of families and young lives. If the Bay Area wants creative communities, it has to plan for them. Let me go to more of your phone calls. Oh, before I do, let me just go back to you, Sonia Dirks, just for a fact here. Leslie wants to know, are the musicians who were playing that evening gone or did they survive?
Several of them actually managed to survive. So not all of them are gone, but there were many musicians who did lose their life that night. But some of the sort of the people, the big headliners for the show managed to make it out okay.
And we'll go to another caller here from Oakland. Colin, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a quick question. I first of all, condolences to those folks who lost loved ones there. It's a tragic thing. I'm sorry to hear it. I work in Oakland in a warehouse space adjacent to many people who are part of this community, so I'm familiar with what that looks like, and they're great people. I am curious how the permitting process and the permitting cost factor into all this, you know, these makeshift dwellings, and basically how challenging or how daunting that process would be to someone in this community trying to actually survive in Oakland.
Thank you for the question. Let me go to Sonia Dirks, who's here with us in studio, KQED reporter who's been following this story.
I think it's pretty daunting. I think people were, I mean, part of the appeal of having these kind of underground spaces is because they are underground. They are kind of self-made and created. And there were obviously trailers and RVs that they found in this warehouse space. And the permitting process is expensive and it takes time and it takes, you know, lots of paperwork and all of those things. You know, so and a space like that would never pass muster. It was not at all legal for people to be living there, and yet they were. But when you think about the sort of the complications of complaints, you know, yes, there were complaints from neighbors, but the people who lived there weren't complaining, even though maybe they had a sense that things weren't completely 100% safe. And they weren't complaining because they were able to live in this space and survive there, you know, for very little rent, which is hard to do. So that brings up this sort of catch-22 of these spaces, is that people will sometimes sacrifice their safety in order to, you know, both live in these adventurous spaces, but also to be able to afford to live in the Bay Area.
Well, it cost, what, about $500 a month? Month that they paid to Almena, Derek and Almena,
and then they had these rent parties. I mean, the one of the tragic ironies, and there are many here, is that this was a party that was about rent. So I mean, you know, this is about such an intersection of sort of tragedies. It's about what, you know, the city didn't do. It's about what potentially this guy, you know, didn't do to take care of people. It's about the gentrification crisis. It's about all of these things. And there's no sort of one space of blame, but there's certainly a lot of questions we have to ask ourselves.
You want to weigh in here, Thomas Peel? Go ahead.
Yeah, just for, I mean, one thing. We've been told by multiple people who live there over the past couple of years that they don't think that all of the money that was collected by Mr. Almena was specifically for rent. One person told us that they continually asked for money for "quote unquote" repairs. That he was going to do things like, you know, get a more stable way to heat the building, to heat hot water for the shower that was upstairs, and things like that. As people said, the money was often collected, but they never saw any repairs, any progress, any work being done.
And do we know how much drug use was going on? Do we have any sense of gauging that, Thomas Peel?
There have been numerous posts on social media, Michael, that there was rampant drug use there. But the validity of that, you know, we don't know. There's no record that we could find over the weekend of anybody facing any drug charges or anything like that traced to the building. But it has been said on social media.
Well, let me get to more of our callers, and we'll go to Linda in Woodside. Linda, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for your invitation to speak here. I'm a little concerned about both the way this show started, but also the way it's going currently. When the show opened, it was described as a mess that the workers and responders had to work through. This is not a mess. This is a place where people have died. This is where an accident happened, and I don't think people describe accidents or tragedies as a mess. Further, it was described that the work that the responders were undertaking was tedious. Tedious means boring. The work these workers are undertaking is meticulous. That means careful and deliberate work. And I think it's important that we do continue to have a very compassionate way of speaking about what is happening at this warehouse, why the people were there, as well as how we're going to move forward. I think talking, you know, something that's been happening in the past 5 to 10 minutes of this conversation reminds me so much, and as a woman of color, this stands out so brightly. What happens when a black person or a person of color is killed by the police, for instance? What happens is that all of a sudden, every single thing, you guys are mentioning drug use, you guys are mentioning weird stuff about Charles Manson and Pol Pot. You're bringing up all this other stuff. What the hell does that have to do with the tragedy that has taken place? Not only that, but the fact of the matter is, a lot of this is coming out as somebody from social media or we saw. You know what? Get your facts together. Think about it. We're only a few days after this accident. Then, right, when you have a chance to think about the information you gather as an investigative reporter or someone who creates and convenes a space for people to speak, then start talking about what has been discovered, what has been uncovered.
Well, Linda, I appreciate what you're saying here, though I would have to at least advise you of the fact that there are a lot of moving parts of this story, and we try to cover it as comprehensively and as fully as we can. In fact, in the next hour, Daniel Levitin, who's a neuroscientist, is joining us. He's written a book about how facts can be distorted. And when we cover a story like this, we just want to get to all of the facts as well as we can and cover it, as I said, as comprehensively as we can. Nihar Bhatt is still with us. So, Nihar Bhatt, how do you feel this has been covered, not only in terms of what you've heard reported, but also what you've read on social media, for that matter?
Yeah, I do think that there is an important sort of battle for the soul of this conversation happening. I really, you know, appreciate the comments of the caller, a lot of what this caller just said does resonate with me, but also the caller that talked about the crackdown, I think, is really important, because I think we're in a political dynamic right now where, you know, any kind of crisis or opportunity is often seized upon by those forces that want to further develop and further the process of sort of displacement, basically capitalize on this type of thing to create an even more to make the housing crisis essentially worse, for, you know, to line their own pockets. And I see that the crackdown that the caller was talking about isn't hypothetical. It's not like, oh, well, maybe there will be a crackdown on underground spaces. That's already been happening for a long time. That's part of what forced us into places like this, and I think that, you know, the it's not hypothetical. I see that happening. So the conversation when we talk about when the victims are blamed for this tragedy, or, you know, people talk exclusively about you know, the lack of safety and how can people take this type of risk? Because I have seen a lot of that type of commentary. It's just, I think it's important to say that this was an accident, a tragedy, something that, you know, could have happened in a lot of different situations.
Forgive me, Nihar, but there is a criminal investigation underway as well. I just want to remind listeners of that. And there are different narratives for something of this extraordinary range of narratives, in fact, when it comes to a tragedy of this stature. A question for you, though, from Elizabeth. Would you continue to go to these types of unsafe structures and perform there? Nihar?
Oh, for me? Oh, you're sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think from now on, you know, everyone in my community is thinking about how to create more safety in our spaces. You know, I was just talking to some people who were creating a fire safety video specifically for, you know, all of the things you can do to fire safe a space, you know, starting, you know, not either it's fire safe or not, but how can you push things to be as safe as possible, given the resources you have? Because we're all dealing with limited resources. So, you know, everyone is absolutely going to have to ask themselves, is this a safe space? And to start coordinating things very differently. You know, we've all learned a lesson, not just here in the Bay Area, but hopefully everywhere around the world. People understand what's at stake in this situation. But yes, absolutely, I think me and everyone else, the people that we lost, you know, would want us to continue forward, you know, trying to make space for the type of art that we want to do.
I think that's well said, and we're coming to the end here, and I just want to get another question from a listener and go to Sandhya Dirks on this. Barbara wants to know, she says, I feel so much sorrow for the victims' families, but also for the firefighters doing this terrible task. How can we do something to show them our appreciation? Is there some central station where we could send notes or gifts?
That I actually don't know. That's an excellent question, and I will look into it. I do know that people from the community are donating food and sort of other things to the first responders, and they're definitely, you know, tasked with some really, really terrible and very tragic things today. And I just wanted to add to this to this sort of conversation that there is a difference between asking why and blaming the victim. And there is also we have a need as reporters not to kind of say that all of these warehouses are terribly unsafe places, because that is a really broad brush. And I have been into warehouse spaces that are underground, that are funky, but that are also perfectly safe. So, you know, this is not about blaming people, but it is about finding out
why. We need the
why.
Housing, but we need safe housing and affordable housing. Sandhya
yes.
Dirks, thanks so much for joining us. We also thank Nihar Bhatt for joining us, the DJ with the San Francisco Surface Tension Collective, and Thomas Peel from the Bay Area News Group, an investigative reporter. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. As I said earlier, we're going to talk with neuroscientist Daniel Levitin in the next hour on why we're hardwired to believe lies. Stay tuned for that. Thank you for being a part of this program. And you can continue online, the discussion, kqed.org.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.